It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 442. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number, 240-949-2450. And that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow. Send me a friend request on Facebook, facebook.com/MikeTechShow. We have the wiki at mtswiki.com. There you'll find links to all of the past shows, links to the audio, the show notes. Just a great place to find some additional information about the show. I am proud to announce a new sponsor of the Mike Tech Show podcast, and it is Dyn. That is dyn.com. Dyn is very important if uptime is important to you with your hosted servers, no matter what. If it's email, if it is a just any kind of a web presence where the DNS is critical to be up. And a great example of that, if you remember months ago when GoDaddy had that terrible outage and it was based on DNS problems, anybody who was hosted on GoDaddy but using Dyn for their DNS, they were not down. You can check out Dyn and all of their services. They provide services for every level, no matter what size your company is. And they currently have over 4 million customers. So you can go to dyn.com/podcast30 and sign up and check out their services. Also, you can get a 30% discount by using the code podcast30. Look at their services. If uptime is critical, this is a great solution for you, very inexpensive, where you can have your DNS hosted on a reliable service. They just don't go down. And it's great to offload your DNS and have that hosted separately than the company you're normally hosting your website with. An interesting point was brought up in the chat here, and I'm really glad I want to take care of this. Someone said, why use OpenDNS? OpenDNS is for personal DNS for your home or your small business, for you just navigating the internet, and it is a very different product than Dyn. Dyn is for your hosted servers. Give you an example. If you had a website that was abc.com and it was a shared hosting on, let's say, 1&1 service, you could go in and pay for a subscription for Dyn DNS to host your DNS and then put that in to your records for your name servers, putting the DNS at 1&1 and pointing them to Dyn, and then go into Dyn and configure all your DNS records. So now, if DNS went down for 1&1, but the server was up, Dyn is up and running. You've basically are backing up your DNS with another provider to guarantee uptime of your websites. Or maybe it's uptime for your email because it's a hosted email service. So I want you to think that Dyn DNS and Dyn.com is very different than the service that's offered by OpenDNS. They are two totally separate products. Hope that helps. So I want to now talk about my project from this past weekend. And as you know from the last show, I was getting the server on Friday. Server came in at 11 a.m. My oldest son and I picked it up. We headed down to, actually, it wasn't my oldest son. It was my middle son. God, forget. You know what? They've been all helping me. This has been a true family effort in supporting my clients. Well, Ryan and I, we got the server. We went down and installed it. And let me tell you, it is the first install I've had for Small Business Server 2011, where it was provided by the hardware manufacturer. And it took an hour and a half after I answered all of the questions. But once I was done answering the questions and I said I wanted a clean install, after an hour and a half of crunching and a couple reboots, it was set up beautifully. Because I had already offloaded mail to a hosted exchange service. Since this was Small Business Server, I disabled all of the exchange services because we don't need exchange locally here. The migration went flawlessly. I really did not run into any problems. It just took time. Time in setting up the SQL Anywhere database for the case management software and testing. Here's where most of the time was taken up: copying the files. I set up Syncback Pro to start the kickoff of all of the copies, and that just went for you know, several hours, copying all the data from the old server to the new server. But since I had my remote access set up on both servers, we were able to leave at a decent hour on Friday night. Got up, went back down Saturday. All the copies were done. Now I was left with migrating the workstations and getting them connected to the new domain. This is my challenge. And it's also a question that I'm putting out there to all of you who are IT professionals. What is your process for changing a local profile that's married to one domain, and you're now substituting it, and now the domain's a different name, and you're replacing that server, but you want to maintain the same profile on the system? Now, I reached out to a couple people, including a listener on Saturday, who gave me some great advice on the Microsoft User State Migration Tool. Now, I've never used that. I've heard a lot about it, and you know, I wasn't into script this. We're talking just seven accounts, seven workstations. The copy process did not work when I wanted to copy the profile into a new one after following the instructions. I found that running FABS Auto Backup for Tech did the job. Now, I love FABS Auto Backup for Tech, and I literally had it running simultaneously on all seven systems. And as one finished, I then started the restore back into the new profile. After I would back up the profile, then I would announce it to the domain, give that person the proper access to the system, make them the local admin, because that was what I needed to do for the applications that they're running. Then I started the process of FABS to put the profile back. There are a couple things missing that I'm going to reach out to FAB about this. One is remembering the start menu of all of the recent programs. I don't know where that's buried, but I did not realize that that was not being copied back. So I missed that. Another item, and maybe I'm missing something, and I certainly have to get the latest version, all of the office settings. That's another thing that needs to be extracted, which is all of the customization of their Microsoft Office product. And I know they are very specific files at a very specific location, and I've done that in the past, but it was one of those things that I didn't copy. During the transfer process, when I realized after everything was done, it was very minor. nobody really had any issues because we were able to just quickly recreate where the default is, and someone had made one customization to their toolbar. We were able to do that again. The real pain in the neck was Outlook and the Outlook add-ins. They have several add-ins, and that caught me on Monday morning when I was there first thing in the morning when the users were in. So any issues that they ran into, and the biggest one was the Needles application was just getting that added into Outlook, and there were a couple other add-ins. So the add-ins were not transferred and installed during that process. So that's just something else to be aware of. What is the perfect procedure in being able to just pick up a user profile and copy it into a new one? I would love to hear that, and I will dedicate some time in a future show to let everybody know, you know, what do you use to be the perfect answer for this? For me, it just happened to be Fabs, and I'm going to use Fabs again on this Friday. I got four workstations that I got to migrate. Some, actually, they're all XP to Windows 7, so I'm just going to go in, going to run Fabs on all the workstations, get everything copied, and then, bam, just get it all installed onto the new workstations. So now, as part of this project that I was talking about, there are several emails. So let's get started here. This is from Evan. And he says, I discovered your show a few months back, and I've been listening ever since. I ran a six-man MSP in San Francisco, and we have run into the issue you remarked about in show 441 at a few of our clients. Check out stunnel.org for an easy solution. Stunnel is a small free program that can run as a service on any Windows PC or server. The stunnel service waits for plain text email on your network, and when it receives an email, it encrypts it with whatever protocol you want and forwards it onto your email server in the proper format. Now, just point your legacy software hardware to the IP or name of the S-Tunnel server, and emails go through perfectly. It is a little tricky to set up the first time, but they provide examples in the documentation on how to connect to various email servers. In show 441, you also talked about using EXMerge to extract PST info from an Exchange server. I recommend using the free trial of Backup Assist to do the export next time. You can install it on any machine with Outlook 2007 or later and point it to an Exchange server. It will export everything to a PST separated by user, and best of all, it can create PSTs larger than 2 gig. Well, so does EXMerge. You're right, and I'm wondering if maybe that was my problem, because my one client that had 7 gig, my answer was to I connected him to an old server, to the old server, just brought up those service, the information store service real quick, and I dragged and dropped all of his folders into a clean new PST. That ended up being a little bit over 7 gigs. I then FTP'd it to ShareWeb. I then told it to migrate into his mailbox, and it did it flawlessly. Took a lot of time because it was a 7 gig file, but it worked. All right, that's a great idea for the recommendation for Backup Assist and stunnel.org. Evan, thank you very much for that. This is from Michael, and we emailed each other Saturday. He says, I have done many migrations and ran into similar problems on the NK2 files. If they just delete the address and fill it out again, it will send properly. Messy, but it worked. This is where when I went to the hosted services, the default NK2 file that had the old paths for some of the autocomplete in Outlook, messages weren't sent properly when someone was trying to send them internally. What he recommended is what we had to do. Also, many hosted Exchange services include Outlook 2010 as part of the package. we did, and we looked at the cost, and it wasn't worth it to rent the software versus buying it. Mayan does so, and it was just a download and install to get the email working, and you may want to check that out with your provider. You are right. I do not know how to make it any easier. I always schedule the next day to be there so we can fix the issues. I use a fiber cloud, and they walked me through the migration and assigned a tech that I could call with any issue. Good luck, and the problems get less as they get used to the new service. Absolutely. One of the things that I also asked is, what process do you use to migrate a user's local system domain profile? On Saturday, Michael replied back, the user state migration toolkit. And that's when I started checking it out, and I was like, I wasn't ready to dive into that. This is from Yitzi, and he is from Israel, a regular listener. Now that you've migrated your client's mail to the cloud, let me suggest something that works very well for our environment, as we also had issues while configuring local devices using the cloud services SMTP server. Add the IIS server role to the new server and enable the SMTP server. That way, you don't have to rely on the cloud's SMTP server and its restrictions for SSL, TLS, authentications. Then just configure all the little devices in the office, the phone system, scanners, backup software, etc., to send via the new local SMTP server. Once SMTP is running locally in your LAN, it's probably a good idea to configure it to accept SMTP connections only from subnets within the LAN and let it handle all mail sending. Very good idea. I would also want to restrict it just to those very specific IP addresses, because we don't want an infection to happen where somebody's mail client starts trying to use that or finds that SMTP server and tries to start viewing spam out of the network from that service. So you want to keep controls on that like you recommended. So thank you very much. This is from Luke. I have just listened to show 441 where you were talking about problems and issues with your client's Exchange server. And I have had a couple of thoughts, but maybe too late. As you have a TechNet account, couldn't you just get a copy of Small Business Server and load it onto a virtual machine and run for the week till the new server arrived? Then you could run your backup onto the virtual machine to collect the corrupt files. Even if not online, you may be able to get your files back. Great show as ever. Great suggestion. And let me tell you, that was on my list. If the server had not become stable and it stopped crashing, I absolutely would have had to go to a situation like that. It would not have been so easy to configure, but I would have had to do something. And I would absolutely have used my TechNet Plus subscription and brought up a box just to keep them going. And that is something I was looking at and was really going to do that. But the server, knock wood, hung in there. As soon as I really disabled the Exchange services, the server kept going and started to stabilize, and we didn't have to reboot it all week. So that was, I was very, very lucky. This is from David, also on 441. You guys, great comments and great feedback. This is awesome. I'm a longtime fan who does what you do. Although I don't get to listen to your show every week, I'm trying to make it a habit. The trials and tribulations with your clients that you talk about make me feel better knowing that I'm not alone in my suffering, especially with Exchange. This is the first time I felt compelled to write, and it's because of the recent upgrade to Office 2010 you talked about, when a user complained that Word looked totally different and they were unprepared for it. In those situations, especially when upgrading Office from the menu interface to the ribbon interface, I usually look for the minimum upgrade possible. In that case, all that the users needed was Outlook 2010, not the whole suite. It would have saved them money, and they wouldn't have had their worlds turned upside down by the ribbon. I looked at that, and the price was $100 for Outlook. That was like the best price I could get, where it was $150 for the full office suite. We talked about that. I did with the main partner who is making the technology decisions for the rest of the firm, and we decided that the little pain and suffering that everybody might have to go through is going to be worth it in the long run for the best bang for the buck rather than just pay the $100 for Outlook. Okay, we would have saved $50 per user, but for $50, he said, you know what? It's probably better we get everybody using the same version. We had three different versions of Office merged within this office. We had, well, actually four. We had Office XP, Office 2003, somebody on Office 2007, and then he was on Office 2010. So now everybody is on Office 2010. He goes on, is there a chance you might be getting a better camera with a faster response time that doesn't blur? I'm not complaining. I was just wondering. I'm not complaining at what I say that I don't really like much of the music that you play on your show because I like you more because you play it. Okay, thank you. You have a great show, and you're performing a valuable service. Thanks, David. My camera can actually do triple the resolution that you're seeing. I'm very mindful of everybody's bandwidth who's watching the show live, and it's because of that I've actually dialed it back. I have the uplink speed. I have 35 meg up, 35 meg down, and if all goes well, I'm going to be 75 meg down soon. I have the bandwidth. My problem is not all my listeners do. So I try to have it at a level that keeps the majority of everybody happy. I can't just go super high def for those couple people that have great bandwidth and ignore everybody else that just has average bandwidth. I make the call where it's sort of in the middle, and that's why I'm at the resolution I'm at. But thank you very much. Now, this is in response to Office 365. And I want to read this because I know I've given them a bad rap because of some people that I know who use the service. And I want to make sure that all sides are reported on. First, I have to say, great show. This is one of my podcasts that I listen to and from work. And this is Anthony. I just wanted to chime in because I have heard in a few shows now people not liking the Office 365 product. And I have to say, this is an awesome product that I personally run myself, and I have had four clients running now for over a year. I have had zero issues, and any support tickets I put in for questions, they respond back right away via phone and email. I have had no downtime with them as well on all of my clients. I did look at other exchange companies, but they don't offer or even come close to what 365 does. Exchange, SharePoint, Link. Well, actually, ShareWeb does. And if you go with the E3 plan, you get Office Professional, always the newest version. And you can put it to 5 of your devices per user. Can't beat that, I don't think. Also, another good thing is you can interchange your users on the E plans. You could have a few on the E1 plan and a few on the E2 plan, a few users on the E3 plan, etc. Anyway, I just wanted to let everyone know that this is indeed a good product with good customer service. He has a link to all their plans, and I want to thank you, Anthony, for giving your opinion on that, because I want to hear from all sides on this. And it's because of the negatives that I heard, I'm afraid to recommend clients and go full tilt into that. So that's why right now I'm using SureWeb, because you know what? It works. It's up. Knock wood, I'm happy, especially with this migration that I've done with the law firm. It's good to hear that you've had good experiences with Office 365. Thank you. New topic, and this is about MediaLink and their router. You've heard me talk about MediaLink. I love their router. I have it in a lot of clients. And a week ago, I went to a client where the product failed, and it was fairly new. It was only a couple months old, and there was just a blinking blue power light. I tried everything and just spent a few minutes, and I decided, you know what, let me call tech support. And I called them, and they said, where did you buy it? I said, I bought it from Amazon. They said, do you have your Amazon order number? I said, no, because I'm on the client site. They said, as soon as you get that number, give us a call back and we'll take care of this. Well, when I got home, I looked it up and I got my Amazon order number. I gave it to them on the phone. No questions asked. None. They just shipped me another router. Not only did they ship it, I received it the next day. I was talking to them at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. I received the replacement router at 10 a.m. the next morning. I mentioned this in the post show of last week's show. And David, who was obviously in the post show, responded here. And that's why I wanted to tell that story. As a matter of fact, I am so happy with their customer service that I have a client that needs two routers. He needs a router and an access point. I bought two more Media Links because of that. Matter of fact, they're stacked up behind me. I was showing them to everybody in the chat. Mike, good to hear about the Media Link router customer support. I purchased one for a customer on your recommendation, and it has been rock solid so far. I was looking at the Media Link website and noticed their products can be purchased directly from them at the same price with free shipping. I also noticed that they offer a refurbished 150N router for $24.99, but shipping is extra. It has the same one-year warranty, and they sell a 300N router for the same $49.99 price as the 150N. Of course, all things and prices being equal, I would use your Amazon link, but I don't think the 300N router is available from Amazon. Your thoughts on refurbished items and a 150N versus the 300N. Are you aware that Tiger Direct finally did away with the CompUSA name after December 31st? I think most of the stores are located in Florida and Texas. No, I didn't know that. And I was actually surprised. I know there was like one CompUSA in Delaware, you know, and I know they're very, very few. I used to go to them a long time ago. Anyway, he says here, they seem to love to sell refurbished items. David from Miami. David, thank you for this. Did you know, and I'm really showing my age, before they became CompUSA, it used to be called Soft Warehouse. Then they became CompUSA. Now, the refurbished. I have bought some Netgear refurbished as long as they have the warranty. I've only bought two routers. They were both Netgear and they've worked with no problem. So I'll tell you what, I was so impressed with MediaLink's customer service that getting a refurb from them, it wouldn't bother me because it was so painless and so good. Just based on that, I don't mind refurb from them. Now, from the 150N, which is what I've been using all the time, I can't comment. I haven't used the 300N. So if anybody's used the 300N Media Link, let me know your experiences with that. David, thank you very much. Okay, this is from Mike. I wrote in a few weeks back about a recommendation for a small business server, and in your reply, you mentioned that you have a few customers with their QuickBook database on a NAS device. I am maintaining PCs for small business that have a file server where their QuickBook database is stored. I would like to swap the machine out for a NAS. I have been in the Intuit forums, and it is my impression that Intuit requires the database to be on a machine that has the QuickBooks database server running on it. How do you accomplish this with your customers and a NAS? Thanks for one of the best tech podcasts ever. Email back and forth with Mike. I was just there literally yesterday at my client. He has a Synology NAS. He has two iMacs that are using the database for his QuickBooks, and it is stored on the NAS. It's not multi-user, and I'm wondering, because it's multi-user, is that a particular problem? I'm wondering if that's the issue, because I know I have it on a NAS. And matter of fact, I have another client that has a PC, and it's also a Synology NAS, and their QuickBooks database is on the NAS device. Matter of fact, wait, I have a client with QuickBooks, and it's on a server share, and QuickBooks is not running on the server. Now, I do not go through the forums on Intuit, you know, Intuit's forums. So here's what I would like, and this is what Mike asked me, what are good resources out there for QuickBooks? If you can let me know, I know for a fact I have some QuickBooks experts listening to this show. So where do you go for your information? Send me some really cool resources for QuickBooks that I can share with all the listeners. So that's something I would really like, and I will put that on a future show. That would be great. Resources that you hit for great information on QuickBooks. Hey, Mike, I know you subscribe to using SyncBack, but I was wondering what you thought about Cobian Backup. You're not the first person to mention Cobian. I have not had an opportunity to really use it, so can't comment on Cobian. I am going to also use Wet to pull files from the XP machine to see how that goes. I'm not going to solely rely on Wet, W-E-T, but also want to have a separate backup of the files. That's where the question comes into play. Thanks for all you do and for us wannabe IT guys out there. And this is from Chad. Chad, thank you. Boy, I'm really asking for a lot of help out here. Comments on Cobian. I'm one man. It's impossible for me to test and explore everything. I pound away at products and utilities the best I can. I have been so crazy busy the last few weeks. I have not had a chance to just play around and test. Give me feedback on Cobian and what you think. This is from Kate, and it's about Java and Homeland Security. I'm getting lots of questions about the Homeland Security bulletin that advises everyone to disable Java. I don't know when you'll get around to reading this, and things seem to change pretty rapidly. So I'll start by saying that today is Sunday, January 13th, 2013, and we have a link to the bulletin. I'll put that in the show notes. Brian Krebs does a good job of explaining the issue in terms of that won't make your head explode. So we have that link. There is, as of today, some discussion that disabling Java plugins in all your browsers offers as much protection as you need and doesn't involve trying to find and disable Java in the console. There are many problems with that, and those instructions are here. They are probably less complicated than the first set of instructions from CERT. Here is my situation. My customers are home users, home-based business users, and some small business users. These are not people who understand the problem or who are actually capable of following the first set of instructions. And some of the programs that these people need and use every day depend on Java. I think simply accounting requires Java, for instance. I have a customer who teaches distance learning courses. She needs Java in order to do the work. The program I use to do screencasts requires Java. So making a screencast on how to disable Java prevents an interesting challenge. I have many Canadian snowbirds who use the ISP's webmail while they're wintering in Arizona. That requires Java. So finally, here's my question. What, if anything, are people like me advising their customers to do about this? How serious is this threat? Has anyone come across any simplified instructions for disabling Java or disabling the browser plugins? Thanks, Kate. Now remember, you're getting my personal opinion here. I don't recommend disabling Java. Let's put ourselves and all of our question and all of our clients in the position to securely browse the internet and use the programs that they need to use. You've heard me talk about everything that I'm going to mention here and I've talked about this all the time, OpenDNS, if you can use it for your DNS, make sure you have your NAT or security firewall, your NAT device for your network. Use Microsoft Security Essentials or Avast for your antivirus. Use Malwarebytes Pro and make sure that you put Web of Trust on all your browsers. It's security is a layered approach. And if you do all these things, you're going to be protected. Yes, make sure that they're all of the hotfixes and patches and Java updates are applied. I have a set of clients that are half my business that absolutely have to have Java as part of their business. Disabling Java would put them out of business. And I cannot and will not allow that to happen. So we got to make sure that we're putting everybody in a position of security that the best we can. Make sure that all of the system updates are applied. Make sure that they're at the latest, greatest patch level for Java. That's my opinion. I'm not one to recommend to just go disable it. That wouldn't be my first recommendation. Thank you, Kate. And remember, that's just one opinion from me. You can ask another tech and they're going to give you another answer. What it comes down to is what do you feel comfortable with and with your clients and what are they using? What are they doing? And if Java, if disabling Java is going to put a burden on them, don't do it. Just make sure everything else is in place so we do the best we can to protect the systems. We make sure that we have regular backups so that if they do get infected and something happens, it's not catastrophic. We can perform a restore and get them back to a good position with all of their data. This is from regular contributor and listener, Patrick Boyle, and it's about Microsoft Fixit. And I like Microsoft Fixit. You just go to Microsoft.com/fixit. I've used that for several clients to fix certain very specific issues. I ran across this while resolving an issue. Microsoft Fixit for programs that can't be installed or uninstalled. And we have a link, and it scans the programs that presents them to you for help with fixing and completing the installation or uninstallation. That reminds me there is an entire range of Fixit for many different issues. We have that link. And also, Microsoft is working on a Fixit Center. The beta is over, so the final release should be out soon. Fixit Center finds and fixes many common PC and device problems automatically. It also helps prevent new problems by proactively checking for known issues and installing updates. Fixit Center helps to consolidate the many steps of diagnosing and repairing a problem into an automated tool that does the work for you. I've used this to fix printer problems where you can just go to the fix it button, click it, and it does a repair. I've had many of you, I've talked about this to fix the .NET framework problems. I've used some fix it, and it basically wraps everything up for all the registry entries and everything. That to do it manually would take a lot of time, and they kind of roll it up and bundle it into one fix it where you can just run this locally to fix the particular problem. Thank you, Patrick, for reminding everybody about this, and I'll have the links in the show notes. This is from Clark, final email, and he wanted to know the name of the software that I use that will give you a listing that you can print of all the licenses for the software on your system. And I wrote back, I recommend three programs. You have BellArc Advisor, I've talked about. There's a good program, Look in My PC, and that's literally lookinmypc.com. And also the tremendous utility called SIW. Now, I don't know if they have the free version anymore, but I have the technician's license and I can use that unlimited. I love SIW. That is my go-to tool when I'm sitting at a client for the first time on any of their systems, because it gives all the information that I need to be able to, it just, everything I want for an analysis on a computer and get it in a great report. Lots of options here. There's also Magical Jelly Bean tool that gets you just very specific, I think, just Office and Windows key. Lots, I think even NurseSoft has a couple tools to dig in and get the licenses. So lots of tools out there. Clark, thank you very much for the question. That's it for tonight. Remember, we're buying from Amazon.com. Please use my link. It's amazon.mikenation.net or miketechshow.com/amazon. Your price is the same, but I get a commission for your purchase, and it helps support the show. Thank you for your continued support. I really appreciate it. Please use the links from the show notes and on my website, my affiliate links for Malwarebytes Pro, for Fabs Auto Backup for Tech, and also please visit the sponsor link for Dyn, for dyn.com. And we thank Dyn for sponsoring the Mike Tech Show podcast. That's it. I'll be back next week. Same time, same channel. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.